Okay, I think it's recording. I'm Karen McCracken, and this is the Oak Tree Research Forum for survey design and tools for surveys. Oak Tree Research Forum this year is really kind of taking the approach of what are the questions that investigators have, some of the obstacles that they have for research, and what are the tools to help overcome those obstacles. We have Rob Schuff, Julie Mitchell, and Bridget Adams here today, all from Oak Tree, to talk about survey design and tools. This is the second part of this talk. The first part we did not record, but the slides are on the Oak Tree Research Forum website. Next month, the Oak Tree Research Forum is going to be about recruiting from special populations, and we'll have a panel discussion with somebody from pediatrics, somebody recruiting pregnant women, somebody from geriatrics, maybe rural population. I can't remember everybody, but that should be a really good Oak Tree Research Forum as well.
So. All right. Thanks, Karen. And thank you all for coming. So I am a director of clinical research informatics in Oak Tree. I oversee a couple of teams. One, the REDCap team. Many folks know about REDCap. Also, the research data warehouse team. So all of the data that's made available to investigators for the EPIC data for research purposes is on my team. So been doing this for several years and have quite a bit of experience and passion for providing good tools for researchers to get research done. So today, it's a follow-up, as Karen mentioned, to the part one of the survey design that Cindy Boris and Julie Mitchell did last time. Our agenda today will be to will be around creating, making a decision to create or use already validated surveys. If you decide to create your survey, some considerations for doing so. Also, looking at issues around the actual design, the visual design and layout surveys for both paper and electronic methods. And then Julie will start with distribution methods and response rates and considerations around that, considerations for data analysis, and then we'll wrap up with a little bit about regulatory and contracting issues, so IRB issues related to surveys. I will apologize once. I still have a little bit of a cold, so I'm probably going to cough a few times throughout. Sorry about that. Right, so one of the first things you might think about if you want to do a survey is do you need to create a new one or use a validated existing one? And hopefully you all would choose to create a validated existing survey. There's a lot of them out there. There's quite a bit of effort if you are going to create a survey de novo. There's quite a bit of effort required, an investment of time to develop a survey that really gets at the question that you want or questions that you want to answer and ultimately what it is you want to measure from those surveys. There's a whole science, as many of you know, behind survey design, and it can take hundreds of hours to develop a survey. And to answer really the kind of two key questions here is it reliable? Does it repeatedly measure the same property and effect or effect that you're interested in and produce the same result every time? You want something that's really going to evoke the same kind of information out of a whole variety of people. And that can be very challenging because, of course, people are have different backgrounds, life experiences, ability to even comprehend what you're asking So it's trickier than it sounds. Secondly, you also want to know, is it valid? So does it really measure, does your survey really measure the property that it's supposed to be measuring? And that one is a little bit trickier, I think. and also requires quite a bit of work. So I generally favor, and as do most, not reinventing the wheel. If you're measuring some kind of an attitude, concept, or behavior, there's probably already tools that exist for this in one form or another. You don't want to reinvent the wheel, as I kind of showed in the cartoon here a little bit. It's hard work, and it's very difficult to get a good result. You may end up with a square wheel. So wanting to take the path of least resistance to get what you need, validated surveys are the way to go because they have been tested. They to be sure that they're repeatable, that they are actually measuring the dimension or concept that you're interested in. But what can be the hardest part about this oftentimes is actually finding an instrument that measures the concept of interest. They're out there, but it's oftentimes hard to find. So hopefully I can give you today a few ideas and resources for locating these, some of which actually make it trivially easy to implement and use. And one of those is actually within REDCap itself. Many people don't know, I should have checked our statistics, but I don't know how many people here at OHSU are taking advantage of the shared library. I think REDCap does allow that tracking. But when you're in the form designer and wanting to create a new data instrument, data collection instrument, there's actually a little button on the lower right that I've highlighted with the arrow that says REDCap Shared Library. This is a database of over 400 curated shared instruments, and they're curated. That's really the key piece. There is a group within REDCap called REDLOC, so I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but that group accepts submissions or recommendations for a instrument to be added to the library, or they may actually go out and add instruments to the library, but they do a lot of research and vetting on these particular instruments, not the least of which is relevance and accuracy and function and coding, but also copyright issues, because that's often a big challenging quagmire, actually, to make sure that you're doing the right thing when you're using the validated survey. Some of the restrictions are either Byzantine or kind of in the dark ages with respect to their copyright uses. We just had one not too long ago where with an investigator where the license said you could do you could copy the make photocopies of the instrument and use as many of them as you wanted and score as many as you wanted. But they actually wouldn't allow them to be reproduced electronically. We had to actually get a special license from them to do that. And so on first glance, it looks like you could have free use of these things, but in fact, you can't. So that's just one small example of the work that's required to make sure that you have an instrument that's not only relevant, but you have permission to use it. And the REDCap group have taken care of this for over 400 surveys, as I've mentioned. Here's a screenshot of when you click on that button, you're taken immediately to a site hosted at Vanderbilt University who created REDCap. Excuse me. And there's a, I don't have a pointer here, I think, but in the upper left, there's a little keyword search function that's really nice. You can search on what it is you're measuring or perhaps a title of the instrument if you know ahead of time what you're looking for. Excuse me. In this case, I was looking for the SF-36, which the actual original SF-36 isn't freely usable. You have to pay for its use. But there is a, if you look on the bottom, one called the RAND SF-36. That has a slightly different scoring algorithm. I think one question has been changed. It's still validated and useful, but it's freely usable. And so it was able to be put into the REDCap database. And you can see that it's, out of the list I have there, one of the more popular forms to be used. In this particular case, then I could click on it and find out more information. This is really shows the richness of the curation that the REDCap team does. That really makes this useful. You know who submitted it, who did the review. There's a nice little description, some acknowledgement. So that's the piece that is required to be displayed on any rendering of the form. And then the terms of use. So we make it really easy for you to do the right thing in using these surveys and not potentially have your science compromised. There's a button then in the upper right corner that I have an arrow pointing to that says import into my REDCap project. And the form's already built. The code has been vetted to make sure that all of the selections that somebody can make are not only displayed correctly here, but they're also coded correctly on the back end so that the scoring works for you as well. They're pre-built. This can save hours and hours of use. So a great example of a nice round wheel that for which there's no reason to reinvent by manually typing all of this into REDCap itself. That's not the only resource, as rich as it is. There's also NIH has put out a set of surveys called Patient-Reported Outcomes Measurement Information System, or PROMIS. These are highly reliable, valid survey assessment tools that measure patient-reported health status. I've given the website up there. You can download those in PDF form. And also the REDCap shared library also has these forms implemented in REDCap as well. So again, you can not only get the paper forms if you need them, but trivially import those into your REDCap database, which is a couple mouse clicks. And some of them are could be hundreds of questions long. So great time saver. National Cancer Institute also has an applied research division, the NCI, provided a link there. They have several different surveys, quite a few food nutrition-based surveys as well that that can be used. There are certainly other resources around. These are just kind of the main ones that were prominent and used pretty widely. I have always wished over the years that there was just one big database you could go to and find these kinds of things. And I think the REDCap shared library comes closest to that. But they, of course, don't have everything. But if there isn't something in the REDCap database that you would like, there's a button, I think, on one of the screenshots I showed that where you can make a suggestion for it to be added, have the committee go through all the hard work of figuring out what the copyrights are, working with the original authors to get the attributions correct and such. And if you just have a group of people that you are have used your own REDCap survey instruments, you can actually share within a group as well. Those would not be curated as strongly as what the REDCap library does. But nevertheless, can save a lot of time. So that was, in a nutshell, some resources for obtaining and using validated surveys with very little effort. Excuse me. If you must develop your own, though, some things to think about. It's going to be a lot of work for sure. And this is a little bit of a recapitulation of the some of the talk that was for part one of this series, and this slide was from that. So, of course, if you're thinking about doing a survey, you need to think about who you're going to survey, how are you going to survey them, and what exactly are you going to ask them. Sounds simple enough, right? Logical, straightforward. So what could go wrong? There's a plethora of things that could go wrong. And this, and some of these are actually even true for if you're using validated surveys. Coverage error, sampling error, non-response error really don't apply to making the survey itself, but it's how you choose to distribute the survey. They all have effects. The method effect is important. A survey of healthy, aged people done on an iPad might not be the best idea. There may be challenges there. Or in a survey in nutritional habits in adolescents on paper also might not be a good idea. There's just kind of a variety of things to, that you have to consider related to that. And then also there's, when you're talking about what you're measuring, there's the issues that we spoke about before regarding validity and reproducibility. I can't emphasize enough that if you are going down a road like this, that you want to engage a statistician or survey design expert early in the process to not only ensure that you're collecting what you want to collect and measuring what you want to measure correctly, but then also doing it in a way that's going to lead to good quality data, analyzable data. So just a few question writing tips if you're going to go down this road. And by the way, this is a 1 hour talk about a really wide range of topics here. So this, we're kind of skimming the surface a bit on a lot of these. We have some of our subsequent slides have references that will augment what we've presented here and it can be useful for drilling down in this more detail in some of these. Your question writing tips, make sure you write at a sixth grade level to make sure that you have good comprehension across the population that you're going to sample from. Obviously, some basic things, use complete sentences, use as few words as possible, make sure that you define your terms. So if you're if you are asking somebody if they ever have had been diagnosed with hypertension, which, by the way, you probably wouldn't want to ask it that way because that's not a sixth grade word, you might want to instead ask them, have you been diagnosed with high blood pressure? Well, that kind of doesn't have a good definition either. So think about the terms that you're presenting in front of people. Make sure they're crystal clear and explicit so that there's no ambiguity in what you're asking. And surprisingly, when you're so close to the science or the project, it's amazing how much we just internally assume and aren't actually kind of aware of those assumptions. So it's also good to have, of course, another person reviewing these questions as well, at least another person. never making the first questions open-ended or difficult or directly about themselves. Certainly, you almost never want to ask somebody embarrassing questions, but sometimes some of the questions can be difficult, but probably leading off with that type of information is not the tone that you want to set for your survey. Remember, your participants are doing you a favor by collecting this data. So make sure that you're making them feel good about it. Paper-based surveys that you're mailing out, you want to make sure that you don't have complicated skip patterns, lest people get complicated or get confused or frustrated and either throw out your survey or make incorrect answers. Make sure the questions requires an answer, and make sure that you provide enough choices that allow the answer to be given. Here's a few straightforward wording practices to avoid. Double negatives are bad, for sure. Those are very confusing. And then you want to watch for bias in the way that you're asking questions. and make sure that you aren't putting your point of view or a point of view in a question inadvertently that might bias your response. Also, boy, the last two items are ones that I find as a survey respondent myself sometimes really frustrating. That's where my OCD kind of kicks in a little bit, right? As if you're using and in a question, you're really asking two things, but and the respondent really wants to answer those two things differently in the responses. So you definitely want to avoid doing that. Similarly, the responses can also have multiple dimensions in them as well, so watch for that. Okay. Here's some pretty straightforward tips on question wording that really reflect the need and how easy it is to ignore the maybe make some assumptions about comprehension, reading comprehension, keeping it simple, keeping it at that sixth grade level. Here, a lot of us in this room would naturally use language on the right-hand side, but that's actually can introduce confusion. A couple quick things about different question types. Open-ended versus closed questions. Respondents more likely to skip open-ended questions, right? You've probably all done this on a survey. If someone wants you to write something and you're busy and you're just kind of in a hurry to get this done, you might tend to skip things where you have to write versus checking a box. And on top of that, those open-ended, open-ended questions are really difficult to turn into analyzable data because you're going to have somebody abstract and code those open-ended responses, and that's time-consuming to respond to or to respond and analyze. On closed-ended questions, make sure that your response options are mutually exclusive, and so there's no overlap in them, and they're also exhaustive, so every possible response is covered, and you aren't having people having to mark something that isn't quite true for them. So always give them an option to choose. I'm going to actually skip this slide because we're running just short on time for Julie. And just talk just a little bit about visual layout. Keeping your design clean, simple, and consistent is key. There's a great temptation, especially if you're doing paper surveys, to want to jam everything up and get as few pages as possible because it gets thick if you're either carrying them around or mail costs get high when you're mailing them out. But actually, that can have a pretty big impact on the quality of the data that you get back. And an important consideration, as much as where you put stuff on a survey, is what I pointed out at the bottom here, which is also where you don't put things. White space is actually something that is a very powerful concept that can aid in helping things flow better, getting leading people to where they need to go. So be sure to consider how you're using that as well. First and last impressions are created by the cover pages and the on front and back. So be sure to be very friendly and engaging in those contexts, and be sure to thank your participants for their time. And then lastly, this is only one bullet on here, but it should be larger font to really emphasize the importance of this, is testing your survey on a variety of people to make sure that your wording's clear, all of the things that I talked about before regarding assumptions haven't obscured what you're asking, and also it helps validate your layout. So distribution methods is where Julie will start.
Hi, and for clarification, Bridget Adams is actually going to talk about some of the regulatory things after me. So there's different distribution types. I think we all should know about these type of things. You know, you can mail or do something web or online. You can use a phone. Be careful if you're calling a home phone versus a mobile, because people will want to actually reduce the amount of time they're spending on their phone if it is a mobile phone, unless you're calling later at night. But then you have concerns about calling after 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. when they actually get free minutes and other things. And then there's in-person, or you can actually do a mixed model where you first mail something and then you follow up with an email or other options. So I've actually done some digging into data for you guys to actually say, well, actually, what are some considerations? And also we'll talk about some statistics, actually, of what is the response rates that research studies are seeing. So first of all, let's talk about factors to consider. So I kind of have this grid here. If you're interested, you'll be able to download these slides online. So I'm not going to go through this in a lot of granular detail. But as you can see, you know, it makes sense. Cost online is probably the cheapest option that you are going to have. We'll actually look at this as a comparison shortly. But it's also one of the fastest ways to distribute, because you don't have 4 to 5 days for somebody to get something in the mail, and then it might sit there for a week before they even open it up because it doesn't look like a bill or some critical thing. So you may be talking a month before, because then they complete it and it's another week or two before they get it in the mail back to you. There's all kinds of things to really kind of think about. So in person, if you're bringing someone in for a visit already, sometimes that's the best time, is while they're waiting for their appointment to start, or you kind of say the first 15 minutes, we'll just sit them in this room and have them take this survey if they're coming in already. Phone and mail are a little less, because people can just miss you. And then other things I thought were kind of important to point out is a little bit around researcher burden is a little bit there, but I'm more actually thinking about length of survey. So how much time are you going to get if you have someone in person? You could probably actually do a pretty long survey, believe it or not, especially if you're sitting down with them. That's probably the best time to do a really long survey. If you're doing something online, they may lose focus as well. And there's a lot of systems that will even time participants out of them after so long. Like, they'll give you 20 minutes, and if you haven't hit that next button, you're done. It's also, you know, social desirability. If you actually were to look at a survey of when people actually want and would be willing, how would they want to get surveyed? Most of the time, it's not online. They would rather actually be approached in person. Some of the issue is, I did a study probably about 8 years ago, where we were doing a dietary study. I'm just asking people, doing some counseling about what they're eating. It was an obesity study. We were had to employ 3 full-time dietitians for 1 year to survey 1,500 people once. It's a huge amount of cost. And part of it was how much we were going to depth about their survey and other recommendations. But if you think about that relative to sending a online questionnaire that may cost you less than $1,000 to probably implement, or you know, with the time of a study coordinator to actually populate and make that survey for you and do a few other things, you have to weigh those costs. And it really depends on what your research is, which direction you want to head. Also, other things is survey complexity. It's really easy to do an online survey with a lot of different questions and sub-questions kind of related to it, as well as in person, because you can train your study staff to actually administer those type of questionnaires in person. Handing someone a paper form with lines drawn all over it and telling someone to skip to question 12C(I)(2) doesn't actually work, and it will confuse participants more than it will help, and you'll actually end up with much more scattered results because of that. So a lot of people really are turning to online. So what are some of the benefits, strengths, and challenges to using online surveys? The first is, for a strength, it eliminates the need for data entry. So you're not going to have to pay a staff member after you get a paper form to enter this in. It's adaptive, like I was just talking about, so you can choose to only show the relevant data. So if you answer that you're female, you now can actually ask them additional questions about their menstruational cycle or something else, whereas if it's a male, you don't show that. It's also really inexpensive, as we just covered. You can do actually questions with a long list of different responses. So, you know, you can do a drop-down with which state that they live in or something else, and you can include 50, but you would never do that on a paper form. Respondents are also more willing to disclose private and socially undesirable information, actually, if they're online versus being asked. There's a lot of social pressure. So it also depends on what you're asking people, whether or not you actually should do this online or not. And then there's also ability to require response. So online surveys have a lot where you can mandatory make sure that someone responds. As Rob was just talking about, if you're doing that, make sure you're really including a comprehensive and discrete options that are really distinguishable from themselves. But at the end, you still may need a don't know, or it's not, and none of these apply above option. Some of the challenges I'm sure we can all imagine is you really can't a lot of the time call someone up afterwards and be like, what did you mean when you said this? There is a couple options that you could let participants know. Are you willing to actually receive a call after as one of your final questions and follow up to actually do more information or get more information about that? It's skewed, obviously, to internet users. So, you know, watch again your population. As Rob was talking about, you probably don't want to do this in a geriatric population. Or if you are, consider different software capabilities. As an example, I'm actually helping an investigator right now at OHSU do a survey in blind people. There are certain types of online survey software that do really well with the reading out, and there are certain software, like actually REDCap doesn't work for this. It doesn't render properly, and it reads incorrectly through the list of distinguishing a question from an answer, versus there's other software like SurveyMonkey actually works amazing. So really, you have to kind of figure out what your audience is. And then other challenges is if you send an email with something, you may actually encounter spam filters. So be careful about those too. So maximum rewards and trust is what you're trying to do whenever you are distributing a survey. So as Rob said, you know, don't embarrass the subject, but really respect them. Tell them what you're trying to do. A lot of people really will want to help at the end of the day. But only ask the information that you also really need. A lot of researchers, well, while I'm doing this, I'll also try to get this, this, and this, which is not, and you never end up using that data, and now you're wasting their time and some of your time as well. Ask for advice from the participants. So you can leave a couple optional feedback open-ended that they can actually give you more information back. You can also, a lot of people tend to offer a reward or something else. And I don't know if you guys have seen any of these mail packets come in, but There is a survey that goes out that they actually mail a dollar bill with the survey. And that actually feels like it obligates, a lot of people feel obligated then to complete that survey. Now, for research purposes, I'm not sure you can totally do that. There's, who knows, you'd need to talk with the IRB about that. But a lot of people are actually saying instead of at the end of completion, at the beginning, you actually offer a financial reward or some type of incentive, and you see your research or your response rates are actually increased above what you would do if you waited till afterwards. And then make the project seem important and prominent. So if you have any partnerships, if it's grant funded with the NIH or anything else, and don't use the NIH. National Institutes of Health. I mean, don't use abbreviations, as Rob was saying previously. And then the next slide is minimize costs. So don't embarrass the respondent. Minimize inconvenience. So keep it short and don't do super complex questions a lot of the time. I mean, just get what you need. And only ask for personal information when necessary. And make it possibly, those are the responses where you have a I prefer not to respond option there. So response rate. So it's so hard to know what your response rate is going to be. Every study is completely different. There is a lot of research actually on this recently, and I found a lot of publications that are dated 2008, 2011, but not anything actually more recently than that about response rates. So it's really hard to get a true online like nowadays because we have more people on smartphones and other things. But overall, still, we're seeing a declining response rate over the past three decades. There's reasons listed up here of reasons why people did not want to respond. So major ones were mistrust of confidentiality, over-serving, fatigue, incorrect mailing address, or insufficient postage. And as a note, it sometimes takes the mail or the postal system up to 2 months to return mail to you. So if you're trying to do like a one-month survey and get it out and get it back, good luck with that because you don't even know what actually got delivered and didn't in that time frame. And then the other one is insufficient incentive or payment. And it depends on what you're doing and how valuable people see that science. So then this is actually one study that was published in 2008, and they looked at the different methodologies. And so what they actually did is they had this huge group of people, and then they divvied them up into different groups and said, what is the average return? So let's just focus on this column over the fourth column over of mean or percent returned. And so you can kind of go through, and actually the first five rows, mail, in person, or drop-in, email, phone, and web, were the response rates if you're looking at distribution method. So I thought this was really interesting because your highest one is email of percent return. So that's not bad. And then for if we actually looked by different types of environments, healthcare or education, healthcare did get a higher response rate than education did. But these are fairly on par. When I looked across industries, other industries that weren't healthcare and education, they're all sitting between about 40% and about 53-54%. Okay, so there's some other actual research studies here that publish their response rates here. So, I mean, it's just super variable. Again, it all depends on what population and other things. So if you're specifically doing a study on a geriatric population, I would really recommend you doing a pub review, spending half an hour, an hour, just looking at what you would expect and what other people have seen that have done surveys. But you can see, as an example, one study got a 64% return rate with people that they only did phone with. And then if they did mail with a follow-up telephone call, they actually only got 56%. So if they started with mail, and then mail with follow-up letter was 49% total. And it actually required them going to that second step to actually get that information back. And then 44% overall were actually incomplete. This is, so your numbers aren't going to add up to 100% because they were targeting each group. And then cumulatively across phone through mail, there was an incomplete rate of 44%. Does that make sense? And then study two, they actually had a 30% rate, a response rate by phone, 18% by mail, and only a 7% by online. That study was published in 2012, and I think was completed in 2010. Again, this is really hard because most of the rates that I looked up, even if it was a publication from 2014, were showing data like the last study completed in 2010, 2011, and there's just so much so much social change as well. And the last study was done in 32% mail, 21% online. So you really need to gauge what the best method is when you're really thinking about how to engage someone, and maybe it is the multiple method. But it's also how do you actually facilitate getting response rates higher and also your follow-up. First thing is pre-notification. So sending a letter ahead of time or while they're in for a clinic visit, or something else, let them know that you're doing this thing, this research study. Publicity, so putting flyers up, so you know you have to get those IRB approved, but do it because it kind of just, it's a little bit more reminding them if they're in and out of your clinic at all or any other areas. Reminders, so if you're sending them, as an example, an online survey, don't ping them the next day. Hey, did you get this? You need to give them enough of an adequate time window of something like 7 to 10 days for follow-up. And you have to account, well, okay, if I'm mailing this, that's probably 3 or 4 days that it's going to send the mail system. And then maybe 7 to 10 days after that, I'll do a secondary sending of the, you know, a postage or something else. So just, you have to kind of add in the time depending on the distribution method that you're using. Advise respondents of a deadline. Sometimes actually if you just kind of make it open-ended, please respond to the survey versus we're really trying to complete this. When they open it up, they'll have more of a sense of urgency about like, oh, I need to get this in the mail by the end of the month or something else. And then planning on resurveying the same population. If you are, make sure that you do thank them. Share some of your findings with them after you actually get everything back, as well as asking them for survey feedback. And follow-up methods are pretty clear. You know, you can do any of the other things, a phone, email, mail, postcard, or even reminding them when they come in for their next visit. So this was the last slide I have on response rate, and it's kind of increasing contact. So what happens when you gradually, do I contact someone, just send them whatever I'm sending them without a reminder, and you have a 56% response rate. If you actually increase and do a single reminder, you get 25% additional response rate. And then, and this is just one study, but two reminders, 12%, and you can just see minimal diminishing reward. So you also need to decide how much effort should I and shouldn't I actually do with following up with study participants. One of the last slides before we go into regulatory is data analysis, and it just talks about a couple reminders for coding. So if you're creating your own survey or if you're using a validated, make sure that you kind of check through that things on the back end, you know, if you answered yes is a 1 and 0 is a no, if that's what, if you're especially using a validated survey. But sometimes they'll also flip-flop things on you where, you know, 1 through 5 was, I like myself very, you know, I always and then never, but then they flip always to be a 5 on the next question and 0 because of the way they score the survey. So you need to be careful and you need to make sure you test that because going back and doing that later takes so much more effort and time. Weighting of questions. So sometimes everything is not equal or valued to 1. So consider that even if you're developing your own survey of what's the importance level of this. We kind of talked otherwise, coding open-ended questions, as Rob talked about. So just be careful because it really does take working usually with some type of statistician at that point for doing abstraction and coding. And also, the last thing I would leave you is consider the time of year that you're actually going to administer your survey. Because if you're doing it over the holidays, it's not a priority. Like, you might as well not even send it out in November or December, because people are going to be sidetracked. Also, spring break week, probably not the best time to think about sending something out, or the week right before spring break. Wait until people get back. And then analyzing data, so incomplete surveys and missing data. Just consider how you're going to treat that ahead of time. This causes a lot of issues and challenges. And also, when you're doing a survey repeated times, make sure you figure out how you're going to, if you're doing it not just at the beginning and the end and measuring that one change, but how are you going to actually measure change from the beginning? And I'll use a quick use case before I close. I was doing a survey right now for a study, and the questions keep on at all the questions to the validated survey say, since the last time we spoke. And we're doing it over a year, and we're doing it monthly. And sometimes people skip, so now I have 2 months of data really in one questionnaire, and so I can't really break up that time frame to actually do interim. So be very careful, first of all, in the wording of your questions, and second of all, think about how you're going to actually analyze that data before you start. You know, are you going to just look at the overall absolute change? Are you going to look at the percent change? Can you even do either of those? If you're asking since the last time we talked, I can't do either of those on that type of question. So just make those considerations and really be careful about introducing biases into your analysis as well. And Bridget.
Now for the fun part. So for regulatory considerations with surveys, if your study requires IRB approval, you're going to need in your protocol a description of the participants that you're going to recruit, so basically your inclusion-exclusion criteria, but also how are you going to identify these people and how are you going to get the surveys to them. You're going to want to have a description of the data types. One of the ways you can do this too is submit your survey to the IRB, which will be required for the submission unless you're using a standard survey type. So if you do use like the SF36, the IRB doesn't require that you submit that all the time. They're familiar with that. But if you're using a unique study that or survey that you've created or one that's less common, you'll need to submit those with your IRB application as well. You're going to need to let the IRB know if you're collecting PHI or protected health information and any measures you're going to use to protect the participants' confidentiality in the survey. So if you're using REDCap, I know the REDCap team has some language they can just provide to you that describes the data security for the REDCap system. If you're using other online surveys, you're going to want to collect that information and make sure you include it in your protocol. In addition to how you would protect your paper forms, you know, locked file cabinet, access limited to IRB-approved study staff, information like that needs to be included in the protocol. For some studies, if it's a simple survey study, you're not doing anything else, maybe you're not going to interact with these people other than the fact that you've emailed them a survey, or maybe they've stumbled across your survey if it's something that's posted on the website, you might be able to get away with using an information sheet as opposed to having a signed consent form. The difference between the two can vary from study to study. The information sheet essentially includes the same information as a consent. However, the IRB can waive certain elements depending on the study. They're generally approved for minimal risk protocols and most often used when, you know, actually it's getting the participant's name would be potentially the greatest risk of participating in the study, or if you don't ever have that face-to-face interaction with the participant. Does anybody have any questions about information sheets and consent forms? I know that some studies now are just incorporating the information sheet into the first page of their electronic consent, which is a really nice option. So if you're doing online recruiting for your studies and you want to use either REDCap or SurveyMonkey or SurveyGizmo or any of the other kinds, they're, as we mentioned, you're going to need, you can have an information sheet, probably it's the first page of your online survey, but to be able to reach out to participants, say you've collected their email information because they've participated in a prior study and said, yes, please contact me for future research. Or you've collected their email information from Epic or some source. You're going to need an IRB-approved waiver of authorization to be able to contact those individuals for research purposes. And if you are going to do that for any survey tool other than REDCap, because REDCap is housed within OHSU, but if you're going to use SurveyMonkey, SurveyGizmo, or another survey tool, you might need to have a business associates agreement because email addresses are considered protected health information. And so you'd need to have an agreement between OHSU and the company that would be housing this protected health information. I mentioned this at the last, if anybody was at the previous survey presentation, actually SurveyMonkey and SurveyGizmo make it pretty easy to do an online business associates agreement. However, no investigators have the authority to obligate OHSU, so this you can't actually sign it. It looks like a nice click-through system, but you have to have an institutional authority sign it. So depending on the study, it might be someone at OPAM, could be the IRB, could be the contract, the clinical trials contracting office. So just be aware of that. Also, if you're using outside tools, you're going to have to use the OHSU accounting of disclosures information, letting OHSU information security know that you have shared protected health information outside of OHSU. So that's just another step that you need to take. Any questions regarding the regulatory? Okay.
I have a question on your prior slide.
Okay.
When you're submitting your survey, your instrument to the IRB, are they just concerned about the questions that are being asked, or are they also concerned about the way that it's presented?
It's best to present it in the format that the participants are going to see it. So it could be that you just have like the question and then what the options might be for an answer. It might not be the, I've seen it go in either with screenshots of what it's going to look like, or people will just have the question and then the data elements that people would be able to select from. But yeah, if you're going to have any pictures on your survey or anything like that, the IRB would want to see that just to make sure that it was continued to be appropriate. So.
And we did talk about it the last time, but most of these survey tools are actually quite customizable. So if you're working with a validated survey and working with a company that they, you know, it's copyrighted, you're going to actually have to usually provide them screenshots to get them to sign off on what the survey looks like. And as an example, SurveyMonkey, I believe, has templates in it that you can change the template, but you can't actually change a lot of the look and feel about it. REDCap now is completely customizable. It is an hourly rate that our group has somebody that can work with you one-on-one and actually help you actually do some of that, so you can have a study coordinator set up all the questions, everything else. And then if a company is requiring that it look and feel a certain way, some of that can actually be done internally as well. So just kind of know that as well as you're when you're thinking about this. And I think that's it. Does anybody have any other questions for Rob, myself, or Bridget? We realize we're kind of hitting time. Thank you so much for attending. Yeah.